It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We're going to announce at the top here that we're going to be
new
trying...
Feature, new feature.
Beep, beep, beep. Flashing lights, have a seizure. We're going to try doing, I tried this several weeks back with a guest I had. We're going to try taking some questions from listeners via email. We do it via the phones, but we just don't have enough people here to be able to handle that. So during, maybe in the first 15 minutes, for those of you that are listening and have email questions for Jav or Maria, or perhaps develop some questions while they're listening, you can send them to dj@kexp.org, and we'll try and integrate maybe a couple of those, one or more, near the end of the show.
Assuming, and we'll try and do that every week, time permitting.
Time permitting, and...
Because we have so much spare time in this half hour.
We do. We're always... All right. Well, let's jump into things, starting with national, the FCC. Jav, you were going to talk about one of our favorite organizations, and one that we pay attention to closely here at the station.
Yeah, well, we mentioned, and for good reason, we mentioned a couple weeks ago when Kevin Martin was named the new commissioner, a lot of people were thankful to see Michael Powell go. But the danger, of course, is that you're trading the devil you know for one that you don't, and it's becoming more clear what Kevin Martin's priority is going to be at the FCC, and that is indecency. He earned something of a reputation as a maverick. He was on the commission, but not its chairman for the first 4 years of the first Bush term, which is why he did not have to be confirmed as commissioner, because he was, or rather as chairman, because he was already on the commission. But he had earned something of a reputation as a maverick, and that had given people hope in the deregulation votes that he would side with the media democracy movement, although he did not eventually. But an area in which he has his heart probably lies much more is the area of indecency. And this week, the FCC announced a proposal for broad new fines. And this is something that the FCC has been doing at the behest of Congress for the last year or two, is slapping really big fines on large broadcast companies. Infinity, I believe, was one of them. There were a couple of others as well, for indecency, for obscenity, for tasteless radio, as they say. And this of course goes beyond, you know, the few words that you should or shouldn't say on the air. And it really is a concern. It's something of a dilemma for progressives, because on the one hand, you know, there's a lot of really tasteless, you know, objectionable fare on radio and television. But on the other hand, there's also an awful lot of it on cable, and there's an awful lot on the internet. There's an awful lot of it in print, and the Republic is not ground to a halt because of its presence there. The only difference is that in the case of broadcast radio and television, they're using the public airwaves, which were a publicly owned resource, which is how the government has jurisdiction in this case. But it would seem to me that if you're going to take the concept of being able to regulate for free speech over the air because it's a publicly owned resource, then you should treat it like a publicly owned resource and regulate for public service, which is something that used to be done before Reagan-era deregulation. But the concept of public service and broadcasting has gone out the window entirely. Instead, we're concerned about Janet Jackson's tit. I hope you can say tit on the air anymore. I mean, it really is.
We'll find out by next week.
Yes, we will, won't we? But, I mean, it really is sort of a theater of the absurd that the FCC is working itself up into such a lather over this at the behest, again, of some conservatives in Congress as well. When the FCC is not concerned about public service or any kind of or any kind of standard of accountability, I mean, to its credit, KEXP does this program, but you know, many radio stations don't do any kind of public service or public affairs broadcasting or news at all. It's just, you know, a jukebox and a tasteless morning show. So it's a real dilemma, I think, for progressives to try and defend that kind of programming as free speech, but that's what it is, and it should be defended as such.
All right. Well, moving along, the World Bank, it's got a new guy in charge.
Yeah, Paul Wolfowitz has been making up to European leaders in order to get their okay for him to be approved as head of the World Bank. But at the same time, there's a little committee at the U.S. House of Representatives, the Joint Economic Committee, and a couple of the representatives on that committee said that they have found documentation of accounting irregularities at the World Bank. Yes, the World Bank, just like many U.S. corporations, is now under investigation for fuzzy accounting. And what's really disturbing about all this is that it's not a small, they're not small errors. They're errors that make up tens of millions of dollars. And in a lot of cases, they also led to increases in interest charges on the loans that the World Bank had given out to some of its customers.
So for customers who can barely afford to pay them.
Yeah, so we're talking about countries that are having trouble making, just covering their annual payments on their World Bank loans. Some of those customers were charged more interest than they needed to be paying, and that is unconscionable. I don't think having Paul Wolfowitz become the head of the World Bank is going to make things any better either, because you know, we talked last week about how Wolfowitz has no experience at all as far as doing any kind of heading up any kind of a bank or any kind of accounting experience or any economic experience at all. I think it's just going to make matters worse.
So what you're saying is he doesn't really know what he's going to be doing.
No, and probably what the World Bank needs most is somebody who can come in and clean things up a little bit, and Wolfowitz is going to be completely lost when it comes to looking at any of that kind of stuff.
So you have to wonder, with these countries that were overpaying, are they going to get, you know, credit for that? Are they going to get
some money back? They should. However, to have that happen, the World Bank would need to have an outside person come in and actually figure out what these people are owed and what these countries are owed. And I don't think that's going to happen. and I'm sure Wolfowitz is going to resist that.
So they don't have a large accounting firm come in and do their books regularly?
Oh, they might. The problem with having a large accounting firm do your books is that they can only look at the information you give them. If they don't have all of the detail, or there's someone who's hiding their mistakes or hiding their errors, there's not a whole lot an outside firm can do. In addition, outside firms make mistakes too, as we saw with the Enron debacle, that a major accounting firm helped set up some of those little accounting schemes and signed off on them. So oftentimes having a big accounting firm, outside accounting firm, come in and look at things isn't much of a help.
All right. I wanted to briefly touch on, since we're already talking about national stuff, there was an article in today's paper saying that the number of jobs created, I believe it was last month. Is that how they do it, just the previous month?
Yeah, they look at a past month. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think this one was for January. They were looking at January's, because they revise it as they go, and it takes a while to get all the data in. What it turned out is they looked at January, and they said, oh my God, we had expected something around 300,000 jobs. The actual number was less than 150,000, about half of what they expected. Well, what they don't tell you is that 300,000 is not just what they expected. The expectations have been revised downward and revised downward and revised downward over the course of the last 3 years during this so-called economic recovery, that in fact 300,000 is what the economy needs in order to show healthy growth. So 300,000 isn't just what analysts expected, it's what the economy needs, and what we're getting is approximately half the number of jobs of what the economy needs in order to be in sustainable and healthy growth.
So I'd been kind of keeping an eye out for this, because last weekend I'd seen an article saying that this coming week, the week that we just went through, they were expecting a bunch of potentially tumultuous reports coming out, each of them a different indicator of how the economy was doing.
Next week.
Mm-hmm. This week, and that we could, you know, the economy could, based on these, the economy could really be heading south if these reports didn't come out, you know, with all shiny and happy.
And if they come out all shiny and happy, we're just going to be a little bit in trouble, as opposed to really in trouble. But the problem here is that they look at these little individual reports, these little individual indicators, and that's supposed to determine how the economy is doing. And they don't look at the big picture. They don't pull back and say, you know, well, let's look at the impact of the economy on specific groups of people, or let's look at it, what it's doing to certain cities, to neighborhoods, or anything like that. Things that are really important to American people. And so that data just flies right by us and we don't pay any attention to it, and it has no meaning for us. And that's the way it's meant to be.
Yeah, one of the reasons that the data comes out that way is that the indices have been the definitions of the indices have been changed for political reasons over the past number of years.
Oh, yeah, and what they count. For example, what they count in the unemployment statistics, people who have dropped out, they don't count. People who have have been so discouraged that they're not looking for a job anymore, they don't count. People in prisons, there's all kinds of people who are unemployed who don't get put into that percentage of unemployed in America. And yeah. So we know that percentage is higher, but we don't know by how much.
Yeah, the same thing for the poverty level, where they've continually redefined downward how little you need to earn in order to be qualified as falling in an official poverty line.
So the official poverty level is now so low that there are many, many, many more people in poverty than actually fit under a definition of official poverty level. But again, these numbers and these little indicators and stuff, they don't tell you exactly what the impact is. They don't give you a human face to the problem. And they're not the big picture. The big picture is what you see on the street when you're out taking your dog for a walk and you see people who are sleeping in the bushes and, you know, people who are in really bad shape. You go to work and, you know, half the people you used to know are not working there anymore because they've been laid off. You talk to your friend on the phone and your friend is really unhappy because he or she's been unemployed for the last, you know, year and can't find work. I mean, those are the things that matter to people, and those are the things that are not measured by these statistics.
Yeah, I just find it interesting myself that we are so illiterate as a society in terms of economics, you know. And this society, you know, is a capitalist model, market economy. And, you know, where we get on the news every night, the thing they constantly throw at you is how the Dow is doing on a given day. And, you know, nightly business report, all that kind of thing.
And the official statistics.
And yet,
yeah.
Which is nearly meaningless.
Right. And as citizens, we don't have any idea really how things are working. You know, you would think with all that info flowing in that by the time we're adults, we'd all be experts on this, and yet we become, you know, stupider as time goes on.
Or less, just so much, so inundated with meaningless data that we're not interested anymore.
So, all right, well, let's move along. Zimbabwe, they had an election?
Yes, they did, and Robert Mugabe, who's headed the country for the past 25 years, his party, the ZANU-PF, did much better than expected this time. Now, that has to be taken with a grain of salt because, in fact, many, many grains of salt because the elections were riddled with irregularities. There's been a lot of reports out of Zimbabwe that the ruling party has used food as a weapon. There's a tremendous hunger problem in Zimbabwe. Their economy has very much gone south over the past several years, no pun intended. And there's a tremendous hunger problem there, and literally government agents have been telling people you'll get food if you vote for the ruling party and you won't get food if you don't. And there's been also many problems with government-sponsored violence over the past number of years. So this is something where when you see that there have been free and fair elections in Zimbabwe, no, there have been peaceful elections in Zimbabwe. There weren't problems with deaths and murders and voter intimidation in that way there, but there's a tremendous
before the election.
Yeah, exactly. And the pro democracy movement there simply is too busy worrying about getting the bread on its plate in order to mass protest in the streets is what it really comes down to. But that does not mean that things are better in Zimbabwe. In fact, quite the opposite. They're worse because Mr. Mugabe looks like he'll be ruling for some time to come.
I'd read an article on Alternate this week that was talking about that China had played a significant role in the elections there and had done some funding of one of the parties, and because they have heavy-duty interests now in Zimbabwe.
Yes.
In the minerals and needing that for their economy.
Another untold story is how Zimbabwe has been a participant in the Congo War too. A lot of the nations in that region have been struggling to get control of some of the land in eastern Congo, so they have access to the mineral rights there. It's a major struggle. Africa is a region of the world that has all of these outside pressures, outside influence coming in order for major corporations
and rich at their expense.
Foreign governments to extract the resources from Africa, because Africa, really, resource-wise, is a very rich region of the world. But as far as development and aid for its people, it's a very poor region of the world. And the problems are directly related to the interests that outside nations like China and the United States and Russia and the European Union, et cetera, have in the resources that are on the African continent.
Yeah, and the complicity of you get government set up that essentially get their take in order for selling off their resources to foreign interests.
And these very corrupt governments.
And the people themselves don't get any of the benefit from the wealth that's under their feet.
Yeah, and Western governments generally don't care how corrupt African governments are. I mean, we issue reports, et cetera, but we don't do very much about it.
Well, and again, one of the structures that extract those minerals and those resources out of there was one we were covering earlier, the World Bank.
Yes.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
That's true.
All right. Well,
and that would logically lead us next to Bahrain.
If you insist, then...
If I insist, yes. Because there were massive pro-democracy demonstrations this past week in Bahrain, a tiny Gulf state emirate. And what's interesting about this, about 80,000 people turned out for a demonstration in the capital city of Bahrain, which is something like 10% of the population of the little Gulf state emirate. But what's interesting about that is that it got virtually no media play at all in the Western world, particularly in the United States. Now, the difference between this and, say, Lebanon or Kyrgyzstan or the Ukraine or any places like this is that Bahrain is very much a United States ally. It has a repressive government. It has a very autocratic government. But it also has a huge naval facility there that's I think that's the Fifth Fleet that is stationed in Bahrain. And so we tend to look the other way when there are pro-democracy movements in countries that where we don't want the government to change because we do business just fine with the thugs that are in place. So I thought that was very interesting that we had this relatively large demonstration, and not only that, but in a part of the world where the government in the United States has said it's been a priority to foment democracy, specifically the Middle East. This is something that the Bush administration should be crowing and taking credit for, but instead it's being silent about it, and not only that, but our free and unfettered media has also been silent about it.
Yeah, on the other hand, when we do care about a change in government, the so-called pro-democracy movement gets a lot of airplay, like in Kyrgyzstan.
Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about that. Now, it did appear initially that Kyrgyzstan was undergoing a revolution. And usually I like to read about those things because I get a little bit of a buzz off of reading about pro-democracy movements and people's movements, making real rapid change when their government is a tyrannical or dictatorial
one. You can always dream.
Yeah. Yeah, and so usually I go and I read everything I can about it. Well, this time I was a little bit put off by what I read about Kyrgyzstan because I was reading about NGOs and small community groups complaining that the opposition leaders in Kyrgyzstan had asked for them to turn bodies out into the street to get people out to demonstrate, but were not offering much in return. So NGOs and these small community groups were complaining because no one was really listening to their concerns, including the opposition leaders. And then I read that the opposition leaders were recently part of the government they were trying to overthrow. And I thought, usually when that's the case, that means there's some outside influence, some wealthy individuals who are throwing a lot of money into the opposition's hands and trying to change the government for their own reasons, or often the influence of an outside government like Russia. In this case, I thought it was Russia. So I continued to read. And what I found this week in particular, now that Kyrgyzstan is out of the news and it's not getting a lot of airplay, is that the money actually came from the United States government. They're one of the biggest, most key things in helping the opposition to flourish was an independent media in Kyrgyzstan. And it turns out that the U.S. State Department has been funding the independent media in Kyrgyzstan for some time. They've poured something like $13 million into cultural and media programs in that country just in the past year alone. And $800 million, the United States government has put $800 million into Kyrgyzstan to nurture its pro-democracy movements since 1991. That's a lot of money. And when I started reading about how the opposition press had printed campaign literature, how the independent press in Kyrgyzstan had printed campaign literature for the opposition movement, and that the money to run the printing press and to distribute the copies came from the U.S. State Department, then I realized, well, we're not reading about a revolution in Kyrgyzstan. What we're reading about is a U.S.-funded coup. And what concerns me is that the man who is now in charge, I think his name is Bakiev, that guy does not appear to be a very pro-democracy type guy. He's actually starting to make moves to purge his government of other folks who don't agree with him. And what I think we're starting to see is the replacement of one somewhat liberal dictator who had allowed at least an independent press to flourish with one who is going to crack down.
One who won't.
And no. The difference is that the former guy played footsie with both the U.S. and the Russians. He took money from both governments and allowed military bases by both countries in his country with a new guy who is going to play footsie with the U.S. only. And that's, I think, what we're seeing in Kyrgyzstan.
Your mention of independent media actually reminded me of a specific on the China's involvement in the Zimbabwe elections. They had actually, one of the things they'd paid for was radio jamming equipment so that the opposition's radio stations couldn't broadcast.
Yes.
That's interesting. Yeah. And that's one of the things that the U.S. State Department money has gone for in Kyrgyzstan is not radio jamming equipment, but money to fund TV stations and radio stations as well when the printing press couldn't run or the papers couldn't get sent out. So, I mean, it's just amazing. If you look at it, here's the State Department funding the entire independent media in Kyrgyzstan, which was absolutely instrumental in
and probably not telling people on the street that this is where the money's coming
Almost
from.
Almost certainly not telling them that that's where the money's coming from.
All right. Well, then that leaves us with This Week in Iraq.
This Week in Iraq.
The Iraqi parliament met for a second time this week on Tuesday. They met for about 10 minutes. Yes, that's right. The public portion of the Iraqi parliament meeting lasted only 10 minutes. And then it turned into a shouting match. And the acting speaker of the Iraqi parliament forced all of the media out the door, pushed them out the door, closed the meeting. And then an hour later, all of the delegates left the building without coming to any kind of an agreement on anything at all. So I think that could safely be called a disaster, the second meeting of Iraq's parliament. At a minimum, they were trying to get a new speaker appointed for the parliament. The speaker could then take some moves to try and get the assembly to appoint a president and two vice presidents. The president and the two new vice president would then become what's called a presidential council, and they would form a new government by nominating a prime minister and cabinet members that would be voted on by the assembly. But none of that has happened. There is no new speaker. There is no new president. There are no new vice presidents. There's no prime minister. There's no cabinet. There's nothing. There is only an assembly that could not sit down and get along for 10 minutes. That's all that we have. And I think you could safely call that chaos. Now, what were they fighting over? Why is it that they can't agree? Well, we've talked about this a little bit in the past. The Shiites control only a bare majority. They need a two-thirds majority in order to approve any post, particularly a new president and two vice presidents and a speaker. And in order to get that majority, they need to come to an agreement with the Kurds. The Kurds, who got about 20% of the vote in the elections, they are seeing this as their opportunity to get what they want. This is probably their best shot at getting everything that they want, and so they're holding out for everything, including getting this, the city of Kirkuk declared part of their autonomous region. In the meantime, the Sunnis cannot be shut out of the government because that would lead to a civil war. Everyone pretty much agrees to that. And the Shiites have decided that the pretty much ceremonial position of parliamentary speaker is going to be one that they can toss to the Sunnis and not feel like they've lost anything. However, they're running into this problem. There is no Sunni that sits on the assembly who wants that position. Not a single one wants to become the wants to take the ceremonial post of Speaker of the Parliament because they're holding out for a cabinet post. The cabinet posts are particularly desired because then if a person gets a cabinet post, then they can appoint all of their friends and family and cronies positions in that ministry. So, for example, if a Sunni gets to become Minister of Defense, then all of his family members and friends and cronies, etc., can get jobs in the defense ministry. That's what's going on, is that people are wrangling over positions of power. Nobody wants the position that has no power, but it's the position that has to be filled first. So it's a little bit of a comedy going on right now, but it's not funny because this government needs to succeed in order for the U.S. military to be able to withdraw, and it needs to succeed in order to avoid civil war, and unfortunately, it's not.
How we do on email?
Well, we got one in here, and you've got all of just over a minute to answer it. I'm taking a minute just to read it. Regarding Paul Wolfowitz's appointment to the World Bank, isn't there a similarity and consistency between the appointments of Wolfowitz and John Bolton to the practice of the Bush administration making appointments to other internal agencies like the EPA or the Department of Agriculture, Energy, etc., that the Bush administration will appoint an industry lobbyist to monitor the industry that once employed them, the wolf guarding the hen house kind of thing? Might this be true for the appointments of Wolfowitz and John Bolton?
Well, it's very much true for John Bolton. I don't know how you feel about Wolfowitz.
I don't think it applies much to Wolfowitz. I think in terms of why he's appointing Wolfowitz to the World Bank, it has more to do with the sort of ideological control that the Bush administration wants to exercise over the purse strings. In this case, it's the purse strings for the world, particularly smaller nations like let's just take an example. For example, Venezuela. If they happen to have any World Bank loans, the Bush administration would like to exercise a little more stringent control over the purse strings for nations that misbehave like that in terms of what the Bush administration wants the world to look like. And so to do that, they have to appoint a real ideological extremist like Paul Wolfowitz to control an institution like that. I think that's the motivation.
I think some people have labeled him a neocon.
Yeah. That's the label, but he's really an ideological extremist.
All right.
Same difference.
Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State, and tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State comes out every couple weeks. It's a community newspaper with local as well as national and international news. You can find it absolutely free of charge wherever you find free publications, bookstores, cafes, places like that. And you can find it free of charge on the web, current and past issues, at www.eatthestate.org.
And you're always looking for volunteers as well.
Always looking for volunteers, absolutely. Writers.
Including new writers.
Writers, distributors, people to sell ads.
I know it's one of the things you're looking for right
now. Definitely need distributors. So if you have that, email us at info@eatthestate.org, and one of our friendly volunteers will help you right out.